morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument is Holder versus Department of Corrections.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I'm Mary Welsh. I'm here on behalf of the Department of Corrections and the Department of Central Management Services. In this case, the jury found that the defendants had not violated...
You're suing for $1,200? You're appealing for $1,200? Is that
right? Well, Your Honor, there are attorney's fees as well.
Excuse me?
There are attorney's fees as well.
How much is that?
Plaintiff initially asked for $60,000 and was awarded in the high 20s recently. Quite recently.
What recently?
High 20s, quite recently.
High 20s?
Why didn't the state appeal the summary judgment ruling?
Well, Your Honor, I think we thought, I wasn't party to that decision, but I would think that we probably understood it to mean only that we were stopped from arguing the first entitlement query, that the certification was sufficient to establish that Mr. Holder's wife had a sufficiently serious health condition. But that, again, is just the threshold inquiry. Really, you know, there are two aspects to entitlement. The second one is whether you're entitled to take a particular absence as FMLA leave. And that is predicated on whether the sufficiently serious medical or health condition causes you or your family member to be unable to care for oneself, unable to work, and so on. And here, of course, plaintiff's wife, we know, worked every single day that in the month at issue in January 2008, or at least told the Department of Human Services that she was.
Yeah, well, but here's what I don't understand. You know, in the brief, you really do make a lot out of the distinction between being eligible for FMLA leave and being entitled to FMLA leave. But didn't the district court determine that the state was stopped from asserting that he wasn't entitled to FMLA leave? And if you don't appeal that ruling, if you didn't appeal that ruling, well, that's the end of the story, it seems to me.
Well, no, Your Honor, for a couple of reasons. One is eligibility, remember, is limited to the have you worked there long enough and do you have enough hours to qualify to be eligible to even ask for FMLA leave. And again, this court has said over and over in Darst in 2008, most recently in Jones in June, that that there are two, just having a serious medical condition isn't enough. And if you look at plaintiff's summary judgment pleadings, all he was saying was, the department approved my initial application and certification, and therefore it can't argue that her condition wasn't sufficiently serious. His motion was limited, and that's the way we understood it. That's why we really thought at trial, when we were about to present the evidence, the timesheets, to impeach Mr. Holder, we really thought that was not covered. Although in excess of caution, we asked the judge for a sidebar just to make sure that the judge, that we weren't going to do anything that the judge thought wasn't kosher. And in the end, remember, the judge didn't rule on the admissibility of that evidence based on the summary judgment order. It ruled on it based on did the plaintiff's testimony open the door? And the third reason that that's not the end of the inquiry is that there's a question of injury. And here, again, the jury found that that the defendants had not violated the plaintiff's FMLA rights. Now, they did it. Either they decided that he wasn't entitled to them, the state's portion of it, or they decided that he wasn't injured by the initial recoupment and the repayment. They decided one of those two things, or both. I don't know. And there were no, special verdict forms. So the jury's decision, remember,
I can't figure out what you're asking for. asking us for. What do you want from us?
I want you to reverse the judgment as a matter of law.
$1,200 in liquidated damages? Is that what you want?
Well, there's $1,200 in actual damages, $1,222, and there's also the same amount in...
You gave them the $1,200. You don't want that back. It's liquidated damages judgment that you're complaining about, isn't
it? And the interest, right. Well, and then of course, the attorney's fees. I mean, you know, if the plaintiff prevailed... as he would if this judgment stayed, then we'd be on the hook for attorney's fees.
Well, not for all his attorney's fees.
Well, for the amount that was awarded.
He was awarded the, what, you said, $60,000?
No, he asked for 60-something. He was awarded in the high 20s.
That's just for the liquidated damages?
That's for the entire claim.
What do you mean the entire claim?
The attorney's fees.
No.
I'm sorry.
Look. You gave him the $1,200.
Yes.
The jury or the judge or whatever, the judgment gives him another $1,200.
Correct. Right, for the liquidated damages plus a small amount of interest.
Let me finish.
I'm sorry.
These attorney's fees in the high 20s that he would be awarded, that's just for his having gotten either the $1,200 or the $2,400?
Yes, Your Honor.
So the additional attorney's fees he's seeking, that would be for other...
No.
He's not seeking anymore.
No, he was seeking the $62,000 for the entire judgment.
Okay. So we're now down. All right. So we're down. So you want a new trial on this or what?
No, Your Honor. We want the judgment as a matter of law reversed because the plaintiff had to show that there could be no verdict. The evidence could support no verdict other than a verdict in his favor under the Rule 50 standard. And here, a jury could...
I've lost you. So he gets his $1,200 liquidated damages. You're appealing that. And... why is it you think you would be entitled to judgment rather than a new trial?
Because, Your Honor, the evidence on a Rule 50 motion, you're either attacking the sufficiency of the evidence to support the verdict as a whole, which was in our favor, and yet the district court overruled that as to January 2008 with regards to both the actual damages and...
regard to January. And
right.
Your argument is what? That he couldn't possibly be entitled to January?
Correct, Your Honor. Because the jury, not only could a jury find in the defendant's favor on that, given the evidence at trial, but a jury
find. And why is it that he can't get January? Because that's after the 90 days?
The January was the... I'm sorry, I don't
why
understand your question.
January.
From our point of view? Because he wasn't injured, given that we repaid him. And because he didn't prove his injury, because for an FMLA claim, you have to show both that you were denied a benefit, FMLA benefit.
Does this have anything to do with the 90-day limit?
The 60-day limit, you mean?
Is it 60 days?
No.
Is that out of the case, the 60 days?
The 60-day question is out of the case, because the jury found that he also wasn't entitled to any of the months after January, and the plaintiff didn't appeal that. So apparently they... accepted the fact that the 60 days ended in January.
And in January he wasn't injured. Why?
Because we repaid him.
Because what?
We repaid him the money for January. The plaintiff's claim is they made me pay. The state didn't pay its portion of my benefits for January 2008.
That's the $1,200?
That's the $1,200. We repaid him. We paid him a check for some of it.
He tried to moot his suit.
Well, we
the $1,200.
Yeah. We repaid him in that we gave him a check for some of it and a credit for the rest of it. Actually, we gave him credit for the majority of it, 800 something.
But you didn't do that until after he sued.
Correct.
So why isn't he entitled to his liquidated damages?
Because at trial he had to show the jury that he had been injured by what we did, and the testimony showed that we had repaid him. And the jury determined...
You paid him after he sued.
Yes.
But that means that you can't eliminate his claim for liquidated damages just by giving up during the trial.
It was before the trial, and...
I don't care about the trial. During the litigation, once he sues, If you then pays him any part of what he's suing for, he's entitled to his liquidated damages.
The plaintiff has never argued that he wasn't injured by just because we paid him. He's argued that the claim, this question about mootness, but mootness is a jurisdictional question that usually involves.
Wait, I'm not following you. He sues.
Yes.
You give him part of what he's suing for, the $1,200. So he's won that $1,200.
We give him the amount that
sue to get that amount.
Correct.
And he wins that part of his suit. And if he wins a part of his suit, he's entitled to the liquidated damages, I think. I don't see how you get around that.
Could an employer grant an employee leave? Okay, mm-hmm. Under FMLA. And then after the employee has returned to work, the employee returns to work, and then the employer starts to investigate the claim for leave, and it doesn't seem legitimate to the employer now. Could the employer force him to work overtime and vacations to make up the time?
I don't know the answer to that question, but what I do know is that you can investigate afterwards and say you're not entitled, even though you're saying you wanted that as FMLA leave, you're not entitled to it because you weren't incapable of working. That's what Jones found. But there are two other reasons. Even if you feel that he was injured, there are other reasons that the verdict, the JNOV, should be reversed. One is that the Rule 50 motion didn't ask for this particular relief. The Rule 50 motion only concerned the amount of the actual damages and the question of liquidated damages, which is what we had the burden on.
Yeah, but did the state decide to settle on the literal eve of trial to avoid having to pay attorney's fees?
No, Your Honor. What we finally realized, remember, just a couple of months before, at summary judgment, just a couple of months before the trial, the parties were at odds about, when the 60th day was, how far it had gone. But, this, again, remember that, and finally, and this happens, I suppose, when push came to shove, the department sat down and said, we think he's probably entitled to this money for January, and so we'll give it to him. And, perhaps this is a question of no good deed goes unpunished. But again, there are other reasons. The Rule 50 motion did not encompass the relief that the district court granted. The Rule 50 motion, which was much more limited in scope. And in addition, Unitherm stands for the proposition that you have to make a post-verdict motion. And the plaintiff had opportunities to do that.
Yeah, but if the Rule 50 motion is still pending because it's not been ruled upon yet, why would a party have to renew its motion at the close of evidence?
After the verdict, Your Honor. After the verdict, and because Unitherm says that a court is precluded from granting Rule 50B relief without a Rule 50B motion. So, and in addition, I see my time is moving along. I want to reach the liquidated damages. Well, first, let me to close out the liability question. Even if no jury could find other than the plaintiff had been injured, the most he, and even if the plaintiff didn't have to make a Rule 50B motion, and even if the Rule 50A motion here encompassed this relief, those are all bars to affirmance. The judgment should have been, of actual damages, should have been only the amount of the check that he hadn't received, because the testimony was undisputed that he had he had been credited the $800 or so amount. Now, the liquidated damages questions, if the court decides that despite all of these blocks for affirming this JNOV, the question is, what should the liquidated damages be? Well, they shouldn't have been more, certainly, than the actual damages of the $357.97. But in addition, they really shouldn't have been anything at all, because the question is whether we had good faith and reasonableness in following through. And I think the jury's verdict is exceptional evidence that what we did was reasonable and in good faith.
I've had a terrible time trying to understand why you couldn't have uncovered any problem earlier. I mean, you're a large government entity. You have access to human resource specialists. You have access to lawyers if needed. It seems it wouldn't have been all that difficult to see if he was entitled to benefits when, you know, or at least when those would expire. I'm having a lot of trouble, Ms. Welsh.
Right, Your Honor, I think that, you know, I think one of the problems here was that there were several problems. One of the problems was that plaintiff was saying, I was entitled to FMLA leave for, you know, 133 days. And we were saying, no, you weren't. We couldn't agree on the starting date. We couldn't agree on the end date. And finally, you know, as time went by, we came to agreement about the starting date and the end date. But again, I think that, you know, the problem is, as the evidence showed at the trial, was that, you know, the plaintiff would be gone up to 18 days in a row. He would then have to come in, fill out these forms asking for, you know, what sort of relief he wanted. Then they go to the warden. Then they go to the department in Springfield. And then there's, in January 2009, there was the audit. We do the annual audit. So it was really, that was the first time that the issue even came up, that there was a problem. And plaintiff, you know, the testimony was undisputed that the plaintiff was responsible for keeping track of his own time.
Well, wait a second. I thought you said the 60-day issue was no longer in the case.
Well, the 60-day, by the time of the trial, the 60 days was no longer in the case, but the 60 days was obviously still in the case at the summary judgment stage, which was only a couple of months before the trial.
Well, now I'm lost. Do we have to think about the 60 days at all?
No, you do not.
What about January? Was that after the 60 days?
January 31st was the 60th day he was absent.
January 31st was. So the $1,200 you gave him for January, that was before his 60 days expired. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying the plaintiff claimed he was entitled to the $1,200 for the state's portion of his insurance benefits for January 2008. He also claimed that amount for the subsequent, and that's what we gave him.
And that was within his 60 days?
Those absences, yes, were within his 60 days.
The January absences.
Correct.
And your quarrel with those absences was that, what, his wife wasn't ill?
We have two quarrels. The quarrels with the absences was that we discovered in the process of discovery when we had the deposition of him that he finally told us that his wife was working during that period, and then we subpoenaed her employee records and we discovered that she had certified to the Department of Human Services that she had worked every single day that she was that he was absent in January of 2008.
So why did you fold with the and give him the $1,200?
I think, as I say, Your Honor, I think we thought that no good deed goes unpunished. I think we thought that.
What does that mean?
Well, I think we thought we had not convinced the district court on summary judgment that this precluded his reasonable reliance on the FMLA leave, taking FMLA leave, because how can you reasonably rely on anybody's approval of an FMLA leave?
You should. Was wrong, but you decided to give up anyway.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so am I just off the wall for thinking that you realize, we're going to be on the hook for these attorney's fees? Because that's what it looks like, Ms. Welch.
Well, no, Your Honor. I mean, you know, in the end, Your Honor, the jury found in our favor. The jury found in our favor.
That was then. I mean, at the time, you know, that's hindsight.
No, I mean, honestly, Your Honor, I don't think that was the reason. I think that the department, you know, after investigating what happened, you know, because they were going to have to testify, they were, you know, the rubber hits the road. You really have to think as hard as you can about this. And they thought, I think it was in conjunction with the 60-day question, And they decided that if the 60th day was
but
January...
But you're telling us 60 days, we shouldn't even think about it.
Well, no. What I'm saying is that's not at issue. The parties agreed that the 60th absent day was January 31st, by the time the trial came along. So we're not asking the courts to make any decision about when the 60th day was. But I think that was as a function of the departments having come to the conclusion that January 31st was the 60th day, they also decided, well, if that's the 60th day, then we'll pay for that, but we certainly are not going to pay for any of the subsequent days, some months.
Thanks.
Thank you, Your Honor. We asked the court to reverse.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Walsh. Mr. Baker?
Good morning. May it please the court. Ms. Walsh, my name is John Baker, and I represent the plaintiff, Zane Holder, in this case. Just by way of a very brief recitation of factually and procedurally what happened, I think that might be of some assistance. You know, in this case, Zane Holder's wife was ill. He submitted medical documentation supporting that. His request for a leave was approved. Pursuant to Department of Corrections policy, he used it as an intermittent leave. Pursuant to that policy, he was obligated then to submit a request for time off, which he did. Every day that he missed, he submitted a form. Every single one of those forms said FMLA leave on it. Every single one of those forms was approved by the warden at the prison. Every single one of those. So this is late 2007 and into 2008. In 2009, I believe in February of 2009, Zane Holder gets a telephone call or a letter or a communication of some sort from the Illinois Department of Central Management Services and says, look, between January and June of 2008, you didn't work sufficient hours for us to pay you your insurance benefits. Zane Holder says, well, but that's because I was on FMLA leave. Well, lo and behold, Zane doesn't have the money to pay the $8,000 that they demanded from him of that time, and that $8,000, or roughly $8,000, was the equivalent of 6 months, January to June of 2008, for his health insurance benefits. Zane then sues, asking for all of it. We go through all of January through June. We go through discovery, of course, then we go through summary judgment. Both parties file competing motions for summary judgment. We filed a motion, they filed a motion. Judge Gilbert entered an opinion that is essentially done pursuant to Rule 56G, which limits the issues that are left for the trial. That's exactly what Judge Gilbert did, which is exactly what he should have done. He determined that certain issues had been resolved through summary judgment, but there were issues that remained. And I think it's very important to look at what his decision was, because he specifically addresses this issue of eligibility. What Judge Gilbert said was, having found Holder is entitled to FMLA leave until at least his 60th FMLA qualifying absence, the next issue is to determine the date of Holder's 60th FMLA qualifying absence. So, as part of summary judgment, Judge Gilbert had already concluded, based on what had been presented to him, that Holder was entitled to 60 days worth of FMLA leave. What he then went on to say is, well, you know, the days after that, it's not so clear. Maybe a jury would find his reliance reasonable, Holder's reliance reasonable. Maybe a jury would say, no, that wasn't reasonable. So he outlined that in his opinion. He said there are three issues left for trial. The remaining issues of fact in this case are whether it was reasonable for Holder to rely on the department's representation that he was entitled to FMLA leave after his 60th absence. The second issue, if it was reasonable for Holder to rely on the department's misrepresentations, how many days after the 60th day was Holder's reliance reasonable? And then the third issue, when was Holder's 60th day of FMLA leave? Now, before the trial, immediately before the trial, the parties entered into a stipulation. that identified when the 60th day was. All right? That was January 31st. Meaning, if you take a look at Judge Gilbert's ruling on summary judgment, he's entitled to a 60th day. He decided that. He said the only question of fact is when did that 60th day occur? Well, that issue is no longer for the jury because it is something that we agreed upon. It was stipulated to. So the issues for the jury were, was it reasonable?
And is that when the state decided to pay?
Yes.
$1,200?
Yes.
January.
I mean, you know, they withheld the money from him in 2009. That's when they withheld the money. We filed suit shortly thereafter, after having tried to resolve it. He tried to resolve it. All right? They decided, I believe, 3 or 4 days before the trial started, after jury selection had even occurred, that they were going to go ahead and pay him for that month of January. All right? So, you know, it's real hard for me to say that that's a reasonable position to take. You know, Zane Holder he's a correctional officer. You know, not a big wig at the department. You know, he's a young guy. He's got a young family. And for more than 2.5 years, they don't pay him a penny. All right? They've withheld from him all of this money. They don't pay him a penny. Now, they say, well, that's not an injury. We paid it back to him. You know, I disagree with that. And I don't know that there's any case on point under FMLA law. But I think you certainly can borrow from due process law, where this court has repeatedly ruled, you know, when somebody's wages are taken away from them, that is an injury. It's an injury that gives rise to a claim. And that's what happened here. You know, they spent 2.5 years. And do I think they engaged in bad faith? No, I don't necessarily believe they engaged in bad faith. But that's not what liquidated damages require. Liquidated damages are assumed unless the defendant can establish that they engaged in good faith and they had a reasonable belief for their position. Okay? What I think happened here was the state, being CMS and Department of Corrections, never spoke to each other. You know, the record's very clear. Holder was complaining about this, writing letter after letter. Don't take this money from me. I was on FMLA. He had talked to the people at the prison. He had talked to CMS. They don't do anything. They just continue to take the money. Not only then does Holder have to sue, which he does, but after he sues, then he has to go through discovery. Once he does that, he has to seek summary judgment. Do you have a question, Judge Rubin?
No, I'm okay. Just breathing.
Okay. But, you know, he does all of these things. And then, literally, on the eve of trial, they say, well, we think he's probably right. He's probably entitled to that January money. So therefore, we're going to pay that January money. It's out of the case. It moots it. That's the motion that they filed. They filed a motion to modify the pretrial order. That was how they did it. We responded to it. The question of good faith and reasonableness, well, you know, Judge Gilbert addressed that. He addressed it in his opinion on liquidated damages. He also addressed it on the bench.
What is the issue of good faith?
Well, when they say that they don't have to pay they shouldn't be paying liquidated damages, all right, they're saying, well, look, we engaged in good faith. We did what we were supposed to do here. And, you know, Judge Gilbert doesn't agree with that. And, you know, I think it's a very difficult argument for them to make that the trial court, who oversaw all of these proceedings, is somehow not in a better position to make that determination. And is there evidence to support Judge Gilbert's determination? Of course there is. Of course there is. You know, we 2.5 years, nothing's paid. And, you know, Judge Rovner, you repeatedly asked, well, wasn't this just a last-minute attempt to avoid paying attorney's fees? And you know, and I applaud Ms. Walsh. She stands up for a client, but of course that's what it was. You know, of course that's what it was. We argued that at the time, that that's what it is. They recognized they were going to be on the hook for this January money, and they didn't care about the $1,200. What they were concerned about was the attorney's fees that were going to go along with it, because the FMLA mandates attorney's fees.
And have those attorney's fees been determined?
They were determined, I believe, I think it's within the last 10 days.
So how much?
I want to say 27, 26, 28, somewhere around there.
Okay.
And, of course, those were a different decision. I suppose either party could appeal those. But we have a situation here where the evidence is pretty clear And not only that, Judge Gilbert, in his opinion, made it clear what were the issues for trial. If they wanted to appeal, what they should have done is they should have, in their appeal, argued, well, Judge Gilbert's summary judgment decision and his limiting of the issues is wrong. That's not what they've done. They try and raise it as an evidentiary issue. That's the argument they make. Well, this was an evidentiary issue at trial. Well, if you want to go with that argument that they make, that's fine. I'm all in favor of it because their burden is so high on an evidentiary issue.
What is the evidentiary issue?
They claim that they should have...
50 days or?
No. They contend that they should have been able to present evidence at trial that Mrs. Holders wasn't really sick because she was working. That's what they contend that they should have been able
to... Well, they could have, couldn't they?
Well, not for the first 60 days, because that it had already been determined. Judge Gilbert had already determined for those first 60 days that she was entitled to that. Judge Gilbert's summary judgment opinion was Holder has established that he is entitled to judgment for the first 60 days.
Well, but he wouldn't be entitled if she were fine, right? I mean.
Well, assuming that were the case, which I don't believe was the case.
No, I'm not saying it is, but
assuming that were the case, that's correct. But when you have to look at it in the posture that they've presented it as...
Didn't they want to argue... So I assume they concede, I don't know if they do, I'll ask Ms. Walsh, that there is what you call equitable estoppel, there is a... defense. If you go after over 60 days, you don't really have a good excuse, but you don't realize it. Did they want to argue that during January he shouldn't be entitled to this clawback because his wife was fine? Is that what they're arguing?
Well, I'm not exactly sure what they're arguing right now, but I don't think that's what
they wanted. Would they have liked the judge to allow them to raise this issue at trial with regard to January?
I don't believe they did at trial in January, because before the trial ever began, they essentially said, look, the January's out of it because we've paid this. I mean, they said that. And then, you know, at the time that they made this argument in sidebar, Judge Gilbert had granted their order saying that that the January dates were not going to go back to the jury. He had said that. So I don't know how, given the procedural posture of where we were, they could have been arguing for January. And I think it's also important to read the transcript from that exchange, that sidebar exchange. They call and they ask for the sidebar, but Judge Gilbert says, I don't think he opened it for cross-examination, but... You know, can't you address that in your case in chief? So I'm not even sure that Judge Gilbert said you can't present that evidence. But the reality is, if that was an evidentiary issue by Judge Gilbert, there's no harm. Because there's no harm. He was entitled to it for the 60 days pursuant to the summary judgment opinion. He was absolutely entitled to it. When the 60th day was resolved right before the trial began. All right? So that issue is done. It's over. It's resolved. So really the trial is about February through June. That's what the trial is about. In fact, that was the request that they made that the trial be about. They said January's out of it. It's mooted. That was the request that they made. So what they intended to be brought up, I don't know. But, you know, the reality is 56G allows the district courts to limit the issues for trial based on summary judgment. To determine, which makes sense. It's a procedural device to take care of judicially reasonable. That's what Judge Gilbert did, and he made these decisions. So what issues should have been argued at the trial? Well, he already says I've made this decision, okay, that he is entitled to this leave. When he then goes ahead and signs a final pretrial order that says that as well. When we file a motion in limine saying that none of this evidence should be brought up, and their initial response is to say we agree with that. They file a supplemental response and saying, we understand that's the law of the case. However, we believe that there's no equitable estoppel under FMLA. That was the argument that they made, that the FMLA doesn't, or that equitable estoppel, the theory of equitable estoppel, is not something that is recognized under FMLA.
Well, that would have been a fine argument, and I suppose they could have presented that to this court, and this court could have looked at it and said whether equitable estoppel is applicable. But that's not what they did. I do want to address one other question. This whole notion that we did not file or did not seek.
But is there an estoppel issue for January? Was there ever an estoppel issue? I mean, I understand the estoppel arguments for after 60 days, but a separate question about estoppel is whether even if his wife was fine, I mean, you say in your brief that the state never demanded additional medical documentation.
Correct.
And that therefore he felt he had a, you know, he didn't have to prove that she was sick every day or something like that. Is that something that was going to be an issue if January hadn't been thrown out of the case, if it had gone to the jury?
No, I don't believe it was an issue because I think you look at the order, the 56G summary judgment order.
Oh, no, I'm not talking about that. If there'd never been that summary judgment proceeding,
right,
would estoppel have been, and so the whole period, including January, had gone to the jury, would estoppel have been an issue for January? Is estoppel just about the days, more than 60, or can have estoppel about something like submission of medical documents?
The estoppel was about all of it, all right? Because the estoppel, one of the arguments was on estoppel was eligibility, all right? And in order to be eligible, you have to establish that there's a medical condition and that your leave is necessary for that. So if there had been no estoppel issue raised in the summary judgment proceedings, that probably would have been something that would have come up at trial.
The judge threw it out in the summary judgment?
During summary judgment, judge found that they were stopped from making the argument.
Right. What was his reasoning?
The court's reasoning was that, number one, they had repeatedly told him that he was approved for FMLA leave. You know, every day he would submit these slips, or every other day he would submit these slips, and they would approve them. So he was, the court said, he's reasonable to rely upon their assurances. The court then went on to state that, you know, if they didn't believe that he really needed this leave, there are remedies available to them. They can request.
So that was all part of the January.
Correct. It was all part of the summary judgment decision.
Okay.
In other words, they wouldn't have continued to approve his leave requests. Isn't that the bottom line here?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, they approved his leaves all the time. You know, I mean, all the forms are there. They said he's approved, he's approved, he's approved. And, you know, then they come back a year later and say, oh, boy, you weren't approved, and we're going to start taking money back because of it.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
We
would ask that the court affirm the decision of the district court. Thank you all very much.
Well, it's your time expired, but you can have another minute if you'd like.
I have a couple of things. One is, again, the estoppel order was limited to the certification question. And did she have a serious medical condition as a threshold matter? There are two entitlement inquiries. Do you have a serious medical condition? And did that condition make you unable to work? This is what Jones says. And so if you look at the summary judgment order, it says it was reasonable for Holder to rely on the department's representation that it was satisfied that she suffered from a serious health condition, not about the approvals. And so this is really very central to the case because this was part of the estoppel discussion in the summary judgment order because it was not reasonable
for... Well, can you deny the principle that you can have estoppel that would entitle him to benefits that were not actually provided in the contract or in the statute?
Well, the court has...
Answer my question.
I don't think so, no. I don't think you can have estoppel beyond the scope of the...
Beyond
the scope of the... That the statute allows.
Wait, estoppel is about beyond, right? It's about beyond the terms.
Yes. This court...
Is it possible?
This court's decision, Darst said...
I'm asking you what you think. Is that impossible? No estoppel in an FMLA case? Is that what you're saying?
I believe that...
Just answer yes or no. Do you believe that estoppel is never available in an FMLA case?
I believe it should not be, yes, that's true.
What do you mean it should not be? Is it or isn't it?
This court hasn't said. My personal opinion is no, it isn't.
But if he's able to rely on the fact that his employer granted him leave as proof that he was eligible for benefits, why wouldn't that same approval also be evidence that IDOC thought he was not just eligible for the leave, but also entitled to it?
Again, Your Honor, there are two entitlement queries. Jones and Darst and Nicholson all have made clear that just because you have a serious medical condition doesn't entitle you to take a particular leave. For example, under plaintiff's theory...
So why did you continue to approve his leaves for requests, his request for leaves?
Again, Your Honor, the warden is just sort of a gatekeeper. It goes to Springfield for approval. And it wasn't. That's what happened with the audit. It wasn't approved once we figured out what was going on. And again, the plaintiff is responsible for his own timekeeping after the 60th day. But again, the after the 60th day question isn't really at issue here.
Well, he's responsible for timekeeping after the 60th day.
No, he's...
Where does that come from?
In the testimony at trial was that the employees are responsible for keeping track of their own time.
Where does that come from?
From the testimony at trial?
No, not the testimony. Where in the contract or in the statute is there a provision that the employee has to keep track of the...
There is not. As far as I know, in the statute, there isn't.
What about the contract? There's a contract.
Contract.
It's not in there either.
I don't know, Your Honor.
So, in other words, let me just get this straight, please. An employer who doubts that his employee is entitled to leave, doesn't that employer have an obligation to seek whatever proof it needs at the time of the request? I mean, he's getting the okay, and now you're saying he's getting the okay from the warden, but the warden can't do that. It has to then, you know, go forward. So why wouldn't the warden have said, I have to go to central management?
Your Honor, if the employers shouldn't be obliged to check to see if their employees are in Hawaii on vacation when they say that they have a serious medical condition. The employers tend to take the word of the employee. Otherwise, you know, it would turn into sort of a police state. I mean, what happened here is that he got the initial approval for his wife because of her serious health condition for intermittent leave. And then he took advantage of it. He gamed the system by taking, 133 days, almost every one of which his wife worked, which we didn't know until 2 years after the suit was filed, because he didn't tell us.
If he had been sick all that 133 days, you still argue that he would not be entitled to the last 73 days.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
If she had been deathly ill for the whole 133 days, you'd still be arguing that he wasn't entitled to the 73 days, just the first 60.
Correct.
And now, where did he learn that he had only 60 days?
He was, when he asked initially about, he went to Human Resources and he said, my wife has an illness, how can I take leave? And they handed him an FMLA packet, which gave the information about it. But there's also posted in this break room and so on, which is required under the FMLA leave, there's a posted notice that explains what the scope of your rights are under the FMLA leave, that you only have 60 days.
Well, the company can extend that, can't it?
a company can give more, and in fact, the state, any employer can give more than that, and in fact, the state has this family responsibility leave, but you can't take it intermittently. So if plaintiff had wanted intermittent leave, he couldn't take family responsibility leave, and that was what he wanted, so that wasn't really available for him, which is another reason why the district court's estoppel decision at summary judgment was incorrect. Because there was no detriment to him. He couldn't take family responsibility leave as intermittently. That was the testimony at trial. And that was actually the evidence at summary judgment as well. So, and in addition, not only was there no detriment, but his reliance was completely unreasonable. You know, you cannot take FMLA leave, which is available, when your family member is incapable of leave
That we understand. I was asking you just about the days.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Okay, well, thank you.
Support to reverse. Thank you.
Both counsel. Next case for argument at